This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 130 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, prepping for a blizzard.
Yeah, you're going to get hammered, David. But, you know, if they close the roads down and you can't get to work, maybe you can spend a day flying your, you know, your little drone around inside the house.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure my wife would love that. But, you know, there are sometimes it's good to have time where you can focus on things like drones and getting a hold of guests and stuff like that. So that's good. And I have to say, I think both you and I agree that last week was a success, even though it had some challenges. We did our first blab show, and we recommend everybody to go to our The UAV Digest /129, and you can actually see us live on video as well as the audio podcast. So hopefully, I think what we're going to do is we're going to do like that the second Thursday of the month. We're going to do that blab show every month, and we want your participation because that was the best part. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, it was. We had a lot of great friends show up, some of our audience here show up, ask some good questions. We had some great interaction, and it's really a completely different kind of a feel to it, very different than you and I doing this or you and I plus a guest doing this, but it's really engaging. The hardest part for me, David, is looking at my face as we're recording. I'm not used to looking at my face. It's not that great a face for video.
Well, both of us don't have a face for video, but, you know, or we have a face for radio, yeah. Or podcasting. Well, we got a really good show tonight, and the best part about it is, Max, I'll give the benefit of the doubt. If you don't like the stories, that they're all Max's fault because I've been drowning in the office, and he's been pulling my share of the weight. But we're going to do something we haven't done in a really long time, and that's not talking about regulations and 333s, but we're going to talk about research and development, and there's a nice theme to this, and I think it'll be fun talking about drones for drone's sake instead of the regulation and all of the other stuff we've been talking about.
Sounds great. You want to run through the topics, David, or shall I?
We'll hand it off to you. They're your stories.
All right. So this episode, we're going to talk about open source UAV software, a soccer ball-sized drone. Drones can land on moving vehicles. Also, mixing rotors and wings for overall efficiency. The FAA blocks small UAS registration site outside of the U.S. And also some UAS rules for public safety organizations.
Well, our first story this week is Drone Code Project advances unmanned aerial vehicles for commercial applications. The Drone Code Project, and this is from dronecode.org, the Drone Code Project is a collaborative effort that brings together open source UAV projects under a nonprofit structure governed by the Linux Foundation. This is your expertise, Mr. Raspberry Pi, so I'll let you take it away there.
Yeah, the Drone Code Project is growing. In the last year, they've grown to about 50 members. They've got a number of technical working groups put together. The board chairman for Drone Code is Chris Anderson. Of course, you've probably heard that name from 3D Robotics or from Wired Magazine before that. He says that by bringing efforts together to establish a common platform and utilizing open source best practices, we're able to build a foundation for a new era of drone applications that extend from the camera to the cloud. He says the drone code full stack platform approach, combined with the hardware and software innovations of its members, will bring about a new generation of drones that are autonomous, aware of their environments, and continuously connected, an airborne Internet of Things. This is a great idea. I mean, this is bringing together the best minds to bring some interesting standards to UAV flight, UAV software systems, and so forth. The members of the project are a pretty impressive group. It's not only 3D Robotics and Qualcomm, but Intel is in there, Parrot's in there. There are many, many companies in this industry who are involved in this and contributing, well, funds, but also, you know, other kinds of resources to doing this. The three drone code working groups that they formed are the Mavlink Camera Working Group, and the intent of that is to help camera manufacturers when they're implementing the Mavlink protocol in cameras. The second is the Airspace Working Group, which is looking to establish common data types and units and formats that everyone can use to transmit and receive, bring some standards to that. That's very important. And then the third working group is the Hardware Working Group, and they're looking to establish mechanical and electrical standards for the interfaces to the UAV autopilot as well as its peripherals. So I think we talked about this, David, maybe about a year ago when it was getting started. And it's just great to see that they appear to be having some success in terms of making progress, generating interest, and getting the right kinds of players involved. So good news, I think.
When I was reading the article, what I was impressed with is the Airspace Working Group, which is, as you said, establishes common data types, units, formats that all airspace providers can use and transmit and receive, which is sense in a void. You know, we're standardizing sense in a void, which if we want drone delivery and et cetera and flying in the national airspace, it would be nice that each drone has a standard, you know, standardization, that a DJI Phantom talking to a ground station would be as equal, sending the same type of data as a Parrot. It's a way of us as an industry being able to provide the FAA this is what we're using, and the FAA can accept that standard and not necessarily have to try to come up with their own or try to handle the multiples. So I know we've had Chris on Airplane Geeks. I think maybe we need to reach out to try to get a hold of Chris for UAV Digest. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, great idea. Another aspect of this, just really quickly before we move on, is the quality aspect of it. Open source tends to bring high quality software systems where it's applied. Because it's open source, and meaning that anyone can see the source code, it brings more eyes to it and a greater ability to find bugs, to find other issues, or to suggest improvements or to build improvements. So it's a great way to elevate, if you will, the quality of the systems involved. So another benefit there.
Our next topic is from UASvision.com. Safer drone is the future of tech design.
The Fly.
I like this name, Fly. It's F-L-E-Y-E. So it is a small drone that solves a spinning rotor safety problem with an enclosed ducted fan design. All the moving parts are inside a spherical shape that has the size and the weight of a soccer ball. I know that with my little quadcopter bouncing off the walls, I've caught my fingers in its tiny little rotors and it hurts. And safety for the rotors is a big concern. And a ducted fan is a unique. Ducted fans have come in a lot over aviation history. There's always seems to be, you know, tilt rotors that want to use the ducted fan, and Aerospatiale uses their finstrons or ducted fans for their tail rotors and helicopters as safety. They're a safety thing. So it's nice that it's going into drones. And a soccer ball sized drone with ducted rotors is, it sounds like it's capable of carrying a decent payload.
Yeah, this was a Kickstarter project, which is closed now, but in fact just closed. And it was successful. They raised a little over 314,000 euros, and that from about, 717 different backers. But when you look at the video for this, it really does seem to me like something that's a really good idea from a safety standpoint. I mean, they were flying one around inside, around some people. You know, it demonstrated how if the thing gets a little too close to you, just gently push it with your hand and it backs off. It's difficult to cause damage when the basic shape of this thing is, you know, is kind of a sphere. It's a great idea, I think. The developers say that this is very easy to fly, that it can fly autonomously. It has two cameras. It has a top-mounted camera, an HD camera, then it also has a bottom-mounted camera. It runs, the board runs Linux. It's got Wi-Fi, and they have an API and SDK software developer kit for it as well. So, again, it's a Kickstarter project that has raised its money, and now it's kind of up to the developers of this to pull this together and actually produce and commercialize this. But I love the idea behind it. And again, we've got some videos of that. Just, you know, look for that in the show notes at the uavdigest.com/130.
And if you didn't hear it in his voice, if anybody from the organization wants us to test fly one, Max would be happy to do it. Yeah. I like it. Soccer ball sized drones, it seems like that's the next step up. We're not ready for, neither Max or I are sufficiently capable of manipulating something bigger than that. But this one seems like I could get into that. And besides, I also like the name. I really do like clever names. And Fly is a good one.
Yep.
Drones can now land on moving cars. And this was from Wired. Research at the German Aerospace Center have successfully landed a 20-kilogram fixed-wing UAV on a moving car traveling at 75 kilometers per hour, or about 47 miles per hour. This is kind of clever, though. I was trying to think of why you would have drones taking off and landing on cars. They are making a big deal that it's landing on a moving target, but we've been landing drones on ships and aircraft carriers and things on a regular basis. So it's not really that thing, but I'm really trying to figure out the practicality or what you would use a drone for with a car taking off and landing on it. Have you come up with a solution with this, Max?
Well, I think that maybe what they're looking for is not necessarily specifically a drone landing on an automobile, but a drone and some other vehicle. They do talk about that they are kind of designing this for civil applications. They say in fields of remote sensing and communication, they say it could be applied to ultralight solar-powered aircraft, complementing conventional satellite systems flying in the stratosphere. So I think this is one of those sort of basic kinds of capabilities, basic research areas that may have applications that we haven't quite thought of yet. One that comes to mind that we've seen some time ago, maybe a year ago, was the notion of for package delivery that maybe the truck would have the packages in it and the drones, the delivery drones would land on the truck, pick up the next package, fly off to the destination. Meanwhile, the truck is kind of continuing on the route, and that the delivery drones would hop back and forth between the truck and the delivery points. That might be kind of an application for this.
Yeah, I just suddenly had a vision of Mr. Softee going down the street and delivering me my ice cream cone.
With the music and everything, right?
To the music and everything. But yeah, it's an interesting concept, and definitely check out the links on the show notes. It is kind of impressive watching it land on the car. Hitting a moving target with another moving target is always impressive as a technology. no matter whether you're doing it in a Tomcat or a Frisbee on top of a car or into a backup pickup truck or something like that. So,
yeah, there's a lot of variables involved there, particularly if the wind's blowing and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I guess in this case, they use optical markers on the top of the vehicle that the drone uses for tracking. That's how it finds the vehicle. And the vehicle has got a big net. It's pretty large, 4 by 5 meters in the tests that they've been doing. That's sort of stretched across the top of the moving vehicle. So it's a pretty large target, at least at this point in time. At least I would kind of consider that a fairly large target. It's bigger than the vehicle itself. But maybe that's something that through you know, additional research, additional development, the target landing zone can be shrunk down as the accuracy of the system increases. But interesting stuff.
The next one came from Reuters. Belgian drone mixes plane and quadcopter technology. The University of
Leuven
in Belgium has developed a UAV that lifts off vertically via four propellers, rotates 45 degrees, and transitions to horizontal flight with lift coming off of the wings. This seems to be a big trend now that multi-rotors are combining with fixed wings, so we get, I don't know, tilt rotors or tilt wings or...
You kind of get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, well, and it's very much like normal aviation. Aviation has always tried to combine, you know, make helicopters fly faster and make airplanes hover. The UAVs are following the same trend. So this is another example of trying to combine and get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, and that best of both worlds is kind of an efficiency gain. Obviously, there's advantages to being able to take off and land vertically, right? You only need a small landing space. But yeah, as we know, rotor flight is not very efficient. And efficiency is a big issue because that's flight time, because it's related to the battery capacity and ability to power the electric motors. Well, a fixed wing is much more efficient because obviously the lift or most of the lift is coming from the wings, not the propellers. Those are used for propulsion. And so that's how this thing is able to travel they say, up to 30 kilometers in tests, and it's able to carry a payload of up to 1 kilogram. So you're not going to do that very easily with a multi-rotor, you know, without carrying huge batteries, which, of course, has a huge weight penalty. The team that's developing this believes that it has potential for a drone delivery type of system because of the lifting capability and the travel distance that it's capable of. So again, we see, you know, another research group that's focusing on the delivery application for the, you know, the research that they're doing.
And another clever name.
Vertical. K-U-L.
Vertical.
So. Right. K-U-L being an acronym for the, I guess, the university in Belgium where this is taking place.
We'll keep an eye on that one. The whole theme this week is about R&D. I mean, we haven't really talked about it, and it is kind of underlying. We've always enjoyed the new tech, and I like watching these crossbreeds occur, the quads and the fixed wings and the fixed wings that become full quadcopters. And we know that Amazon's revised its thing to have a quadcopter / fixed wing. So very interesting technology. And again, you know, the one thing we don't ever get to talk about, Max, is battery life. Nobody seems to be having quantum leaps on these batteries, keeping them safe or getting them to last longer. I don't know.
There is one development that I've been noting recently, which is fuel cells. And I think there were some demonstrations of that concept at the CES that just finished, the Consumer Electronics Show. These are little devices now powered by hydrogen, and the only byproduct is water, but they generate electricity. Fuel cells have been around for a long, long time. but they really haven't become as commercialized as a lot of people were hoping. But there are a number of companies looking at them these days for applications on small UAVs, which, like you say, David, is where you need a lot of power in just a small amount of weight. So energy density is a big issue. Lithium polymer cells, they provide a pretty high energy density, but there's issues with them in terms of safety and all that. So fuel cells may be where this goes. And you know what? Maybe the opportunity to do something really significant with small unmanned aircraft is just the kind of motivation that's needed to really push the fuel cell technology into an area that's really viable. We can hope, but that would really change things a lot.
As a side note, I went and picked up my wife today at the university she works at, and there was a big sign on the wall showing the hoverboards with a notice saying that they are forbidden on the campus because of their exploding batteries. I thought that was kind of, it was like, wow, it was sort of interesting that this university has actually chosen to forbid them on campus for their explosive nature, and you know, and they're not allowed to be put on airplanes, etc. But it does show how risky the LiPo or lithium batteries are. So it was just one more reminder. It was like, wow, okay, that's kind of funny that, you know, I wasn't expecting to see a notice like that. But yeah, if you got one at Christmas at my wife's university, they don't want you using it on campus. You leave it at home.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some feedback. Our first one tonight was from Dale, and Dale lives overseas as an expat in France, and he wanted to do the right thing and register a drone and couldn't. Could he, Max?
No. He found that when he went to the FAA SUAS registration web page, that's registermyuas.faa.gov, it's blocked. And the problem with that is that if, you know, you're a tourist or if you're coming to the U.S. to participate in a drone racing competition, you can't register, well, at least until you get here. Now, we kind of asked our friends around the world to try to get into the FAA registration webpage. And we've confirmed this is happening pretty much everywhere. I mean, the UK, Italy, Australia, New Zealand, some other places we heard from folks who likewise got that error message. So our question to the FAA is, why is that page blocked for those outside the US? Now, I mean, I can understand that maybe they don't want everybody around the world registering in the FAA site, but what about for tourists and those who are coming to the U.S. with their drones who want to get their registration number before coming here? It's an open question. We'll try to reach out to the FAA and see if we can get an answer, but I'm just curious.
I was very impressed watching all of a sudden you sending out emails across. I was kind of impressed at our global reach, that we could tap that many countries to do tests and get responses very quickly. And all of them were failed. And the FAA wants people who are coming here to the country to register. So I don't know. Wait, this is just one of those. It's like, okay, we don't know. So, but let's move on to other things. The next feedback was from Tim Trott, who has been a guest on the show. And he sent us a link to another friend of the show, Jonathan Ruprecht, about three things safety officials should know about drones.
Public safety officials.
Okay. Public safety officials should know about drones. And those are, Max?
Well, there's three of them. The pilot of a public aircraft does not need to be an FAA licensed pilot.
Okay. And really, that should say a public drone.
Right. The aircraft or drone flown does not need to have an FAA airworthiness certificate, and public drone operators can deploy their drones in emergencies if they already have a COA that does not require a 24-hour NOTAM, because otherwise that's the requirement, 24 hours. if you're an emergency response team deploying a drone to evaluate a situation, obviously you're not going to file 24 hours in advance. Tim had some observations based on this, which are kind of interesting. And he states that the AMA says that its members, which are part of a community organization, they're authorized to fly model aircraft up to 500 feet and at night, while at the same time, other hobby flyers who are not members of the AMA are limited to 400 feet and just daylight operation. That's interesting. Also, under Section 334, Tim notes that exemption, a public agency self-certifies its UAV operators and pilots and can designate anyone as a PIC, as a pilot in command, within the limits of their COA. No specified requirement for aeronautical knowledge. Okay, now stick with us. The third point, a Section 333 holder is required to be or to employ a certified pilot as the operator or PIC, or must obtain pilot certification, and is thus rewarded, Tim says, by the most limitations, 200 feet, daylight operation, or a special COA grant up to 400 feet. So Tim's pointing out that this entire structure seems upside down because it kind of operates against itself. You're rewarded for meeting the highest standards, a Section 333 exemption, with the most restrictions and limitations. So I think, David, it's kind of a very interesting observation that, you know, when you look at the requirements for each of these categories of operators and what they're allowed to do, it doesn't all flow. It's not logically consistent.
Partly, I think the reason why is I think they were done, I don't want to say out of order, but they were done as separate universes.
Yeah, yeah.
They weren't, I mean, literally, the FAA worked on it as three separate problems. And unfortunately, I'm kind of having this in my day job. This is kind of the story of the universes. I have some programs that were set up that are inexorably linked together, but they were set up as three separate entities, and trying to get them to flow together now is really hard because they only looked at one problem, answered it, and didn't look at how it affects other departments and other problems. And I can understand why this is what it is. I don't say it's right, but I can understand why the FAA has resulted with this, because they looked at three different problems and came up with three different answers to those problems, but not necessarily looking at the big picture. It was more of a micromanagement instead of a macro management. So I know I said at the beginning of the episode we weren't going to talk too much about regulations, but this is feedback. It's not regulations. So
it's hard to stay away.
We'd like to thank Tim for the thoughts and the way he's analyzed it, which he's right.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, that given that this is where we are, the most important thing is, okay, so what's the process by which we get to a better place? I really view it as a first pass, and hopefully, those who can improve this are working on the next iteration of this to, kind of make things better.
Oh, and I do want to let everybody know that Max and I are actively working on trying to get a hold of the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2016. It's still in committee, so they haven't quite released it out yet. But we want to see how that fits in with the drone regulations, because Congress originally said in the 2012 authorization that model airplanes were not the purveyance of the FAA, and the FAA has changed that since then. So we're working on that. I have a feeling that I'm going to start doing some research as far as our elected officials to find out who we can touch base with to find out more about where we're going with the reauthorization, because it affects also our other show, the Airplane Geeks. The FAA reauthorization has an effect on everybody who listens to that show in the United States. we're looking forward to having some good guests on in 2016 to bring some more insight on that. What do you think? You think it was a good discussion about R&D? A lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, we just touched on some of them. There are a lot of other interesting efforts going on to develop some things that are really going to be important to this industry in the future. And so we look forward to telling you about more of them. If you run across some that you'd like us to take a look at or like us to talk about on the show, please feel free to send those to us. So with that, we'll thank you for listening to this episode of the UAV Digest. It's been episode 130. So if you want to go straight to the show notes, that's the uavdigest.com/130. And of course, we're also all over social media. David, maybe you can tell folks about some of those places.
Thanks, Max. I think I will. You can find us on Twitter. We have an active Twitter community at UAV Digest. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/UAV Digest. And of course, if you want to send us email and send us articles and send us, I'm always asking, if you've gone out and you shot some video with your drone, we'd love to see it. So send that to feedback@theuavdigest.com. And if you want to help the show, you can leave a review on iTunes. That way other people can find us. Or Stitcher.com if you stream it to your phone. And you can always get some swag at our Cafe Press store or become a patron to the show at patreon.com/theuavdigest. So with that, I would like to say this is David hunkering down for a blizzard.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.